Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's good for your kids? Nearly all parents strive to provide their children with a firm foundation for productive, healthy, and happy lives. But here's the rub. While we tend to be pretty confident about what is best for our progeny, it turns out a lot of the conventional wisdom, even of our modern enlightened era, is wrong. Recent studies on everything from corporal punishment to academic giftedness to educational TV show that postmodern parenting might need a little tweaking. Journalist Poe Bronson and his co-author Ashley Merriman pull a lot of this new research together in their new book, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. And Poe Bronson is here now to talk about what he has learned. Poe, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You start the book with what reads as a sort of stark reminder that we are not, in fact, as smart as we think we are. What we believe to be our instincts as parents aren't truly instincts at all.
You know, I read those parenting manuals when my son was born and then shelved them away and then glanced at them again for a year when my daughter was born. Apologize for coughing there. For the most part, I thought I didn't really need these. You know, I could go on my instincts. I was fiercely in love with my children. I was a very close observer of their lives, and I thought I was doing just fine. And what it turns out is that what we think of as instincts, there is such a thing as instincts, but we know the neurobiology of it. There is a certain neural network that lights up with the help of oxytocin when you're first handed your child. But that instinct is an instinct to fiercely protect and nurture your child. It doesn't encode any sort of specific strategies for how to do that, for what works best. Those are things we seem to glean from our own personal biases, from a lot of old theoretical science that has now been disproven psychology, and fads as well. And that a lot of our instincts are polluted in a way, and we can't trust them the way we maybe thought we had.
You talk about disproven psychology. One thing that is a huge source of stress for a lot of families is sibling rivalry. And the assumption has been, and I suppose this is sort of narcissistic for us parents, that it's about their desire for a larger share of mom and dad's love and affection.
The Freudian notion that siblings are eternally locked in the struggle for a little more time with mom or with dad. But when you do empirical polling of siblings in this work, did a lot of work on this, what they actually fight over, that ranks dead last. It's not that that's not operant to some extent in kids' lives, and more so in some kids' lives, but it masks and distracts from a more important truth, which is that even in families where all the kids get plenty of attention, they'll fight a lot, they'll argue, they'll bicker. Yeah, it doesn't seem to stop this behavior from going on. What turns out to rank number one in what kids fight over is sharing the castle's toys, more of a King Lear notion than a Freudian notion. You know, sharing the Wii, sharing the remote control, sharing the Lego toys, whatever it might be.
Yeah, my kids will fight over food sometimes, and I think it's not like you don't get enough to eat, but I guess it's that primal urge of theirs to get enough for themselves.
I've got two. You know, siblings statistically are brutal to each other. They on average will come to conflict 3.5 times per hour, which will add up to 10 minutes of every hour spent arguing. In observational studies, they will make 700% or 7 times more negative and controlling statements to each other than they would in a similar observational study of the same siblings with their best friends.
Hmm.
So we're 7 times worse to our siblings than we are to our friends. Now, why would this be the case? Well, you know, if a child is mean to her friends or his friends, eventually their friends can be like, you know, I don't like you. I'm leaving. But siblings have no such incentive. Siblings are genetically sentenced to live together with no time off for good behavior. They're going to be there tomorrow no matter what. And as a result, some of the rules of society are sort of thrown out the window, and there's no reason to hide your rage.
On the other hand, when, you know, we all hope that regardless of how they're getting along or not getting along today, we all hope that they'll be there for each other as adults. And in fact, scientists have found that you can predict this before the second child or third child or fourth child even comes along.
It's kind kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we have to orient audiences to this. Dr. Lori Kramer has done, she's an amazing researcher of siblings, and she has followed sibling pairs from infancy to adulthood, actually from even before infancy, before the younger sibling was born. She was videotaping the older sibling with their best friend. And she tracked these sibling pairs, you know, into well into their 20s. And she's teased out the secret indicators in early childhood life that predict good relationships with grown-ups. And one of those things is how well the older sibling and his or her best friend, as toddlers, preschoolers, played together, especially how, if you scored their videotape of their shared fantasy play, whether they're able to do this in a reciprocal, mutual style. You know, one kid wants to play ninja, the other one wants to play cowboy. They figure it out, they come up with a scenario, and they inhabit it for a while together. Brothers and sisters who could do that, or older siblings with their best friend who could do that, then brought that relationship to the younger sibling, that relationship style to the younger sibling when the younger sibling was born. And then because they were able to repeat that, they tended to have great relationships throughout childhood and as grown-ups, even if they fought a lot, even if their fighting was quite intense. It turns out that it's more about how much having good times playing together to outnumber the bad times than it is about not fighting. Kids who don't fight tend not to play together. Siblings who don't fight tend not to play together. And those who don't fight or play together tend not to have relationships as grown-ups.
And one good takeaway from this for parents is that instead of reading all the magazines that tell you how to help resolve your kids' conflicts, you're better off spending your time and energy trying to prevent them.
Where we're supposed to focus our attention, per Kramer science here, is on helping our kids develop the skills of initiating play together, approaching each other, recognizing when you know Big Brother isn't ready to play right now, and when he might be, and how to ask. And how not just to grab the toy and say and pull it away as a way of saying let's share, right? And so kids have to learn these skills. And if they're and Kramer does these interventions where she teaches these kids these skills on the weekend, and then she watches their relationships over time, and they work very well. And yes, we want to mediate their disputes to some extent, but it turns out not to matter how we do it. What matters is how much playtime the kids get together. In my case. Because my son can just go off and play by himself, I will tell him, you know, I want to see you play with your sister for a few hours today. And I'm going to say, you guys go downstairs and figure it out. And they're like, okay. And they go downstairs and they start playing together and they have a great time. And it helps balance out some of the antagonism that happens at other points throughout the week.
And one thing that's happening, particularly in school settings, is that people have discovered that having kids, even very young children, come up with a play plan for the day may be a good way to keep them on track and sort of help them develop attention spans and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. So let's just talk about play planning. So, you know, when I was reading this research, you know, there's different ways of creating a play plan, but I would have a day off from work and be with my daughter, and she's the kind of girl who loves her baby dolls and her princess stuff, and you know, she would get all her baby dolls together and put little blankets on them all and put them to sleep, and I would be like, you know, let's come up with a play plan. Why don't you wake the babies up, and it'll take them off, drive them off to school in a school bus, and then teach them for the day, and then give them food. And we would make we'd do little drawings of the school bus on a piece of paper, and then a drawing of, like, a school setting, a little you know, iconic little sketch or something that would work as much. Because she couldn't read. She was three, but she could understand the pictures. And then this became her thing, and she'd be off for, like, hours doing her play and sticking to her plan. And she loved it because she loves planning. She's much like her mother. And what you're teaching kids is extended play. You know, it's one thing for kids to be randomly running around the playground and distracted every minute by what some other kid is doing, and they're turning their heads, and it's chaotic. Because another thing to see a child who's self-directed, who's so absorbed in their scenario, in their playing, that they don't even notice the distractions around them. Hmm. And it turns out that kids who can play longer, there's a very simple test. If you think about it for a second, for those who have kids who are four or five out there, ask yourself, what's your child's favorite toy, and how long does your child play with it? Is it more or less than 10 minutes? And it turns out that if it's more than 10 minutes, this is fabulously predictive of lots of good outcomes. You're creating an intrinsically oriented child who's not focused on external rewards, who can avoid distractions because they it's not because they're obedient, it's not because they're really sort of learning to control their impulses as much as because they're learning to get absorbed in something they love.
Another thing that we worry about, Poe, is kids imitating what they see on TV, particularly if they happen to be watching something that shows a lot of violence.
Yeah.
So we say no to Ninja Turtles and no to Power Rangers and yes to Arthur and even the Disney Channel. But in fact, the lessons they're learning in those other places might be detrimental.
Yes. Dr. Jamie Ostroff did this work where he was following kids for several years to see exactly what TV shows they watched at home. And then he had a whole bevy of graduate students in the preschools, in the classrooms, on the play areas, watching the kids for what kind of aggression they demonstrated. And the one thing we're attuned to as parents is physical aggression. We're wondering, are they watching Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles, and then are they beating each other up in school? And there does seem to be only a very, very modest orientation or inclination or correlation in that direction. What was surprisingly much stronger in Ostroff's research, so strong that it disturbed him and he had to reproduce it on different samples, and it did reproduce, was that the kids who were watching Arthur and other educational television were having modeled for them a lot of relational aggression, being verbally bossy and insulting each other and putting other characters down. And the kids who watched those shows, in a much stronger effect, were acting out at school, being very relationally aggressive and very bossy. And now, I won't say this is all bad. I mean, these kids are also learning language from these shows, and they were learning pro-social behavior as well. But a lot of what you would see on the playground, you know, physical aggression is not that common. But relational aggression is a mile a minute, and it's coming all the time. And it seems to be something kids are learning from stories and characters in these episodes that, despite their happy endings, nevertheless, they spend more of the minutes, more of the pages of a book, building up the drama, watching characters be cruel and taunt and belittle and blame each other for most of the story, and then they finally make up in the end. But the kids don't put those two together and see the way these kids, you know, the characters in the story are treating each other. And they're like, that's cool. I'm going to try that at school tomorrow. Or I'm going to try that on my sibling.
Yeah, so they're sort of assuming that what they're seeing in terms of the conflict is maybe what everybody else is doing.
Right, they're saying this is what kids do. And they learn novel ways to be cruel to their peers and their siblings that they'd never considered before.
Wow. Poe Bronson is my guest. He is a journalist whose new book is called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. The book is written with Ashley Merriman. We're going to take a break here in just a moment, but after the break, you can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org. You can also get to us on the phone. That telephone number, as always, is 1-800-933-5372. More New Thinking About Children after the break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Poe Bronson. He's a journalist whose new book is called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or try us at think@kera.org. Let's talk for a minute, Poe, about parental conflicts. Many partners assume that it's not good for their kids to witness their arguments, but in fact, it's usually okay as long as we also make sure they witness the resolution.
Yeah, this is we've heard for so long that we shouldn't expose our kids to conflict. And if parents could really do that, if they weren't fighting at all, or they weren't fighting in front of the kids, that might work, but it doesn't seem to actually be the case. I mean, according to the work by Mark Cummings of Notre Dame on this, when asked to keep diaries, spouses will admit that they're bickering 7 times a day, and they're showing hostile feelings towards each other more often than really sort of romantic and loving feelings, and that we might think we're protecting kids from seeing any of this, but the kids really do see bits of it, and they're aware of it. And Cummings' work has come up with something quite surprising. I mean, he was for a long time one of the scholars saying, don't fight in front of your kids. But it turned out that if kids can see their parents even get quite heated, but then work it out, and resolve it, not fakey-fakey, but, really work through it, that this was making kids ultimately better off, and they were having better well-being at school, and they had better relationships, and they were understanding the art of working things out when you get upset. And kids who would never see that don't really know what to do, what strategies to take when they are upset with their sibling, with their friends, with their family members.
Our generation of dads, meaning people our age who are raising kids these days, is by and large far more involved in their kids' day-to-day lives than their own fathers and certainly their grandfathers. How have those expanded roles affected dynamics within families?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Dr. Sarah Shope Sullivan did this work looking at children's aggression as rated by teachers and peers at school. And she was interested in what kind of fathers these kids had. So she was doing this study, and she found that she had a certain group. It was about a third were traditional dads, and a large sample were progressive dads, and a small sample were sort of disengaged dads. And the progressive dads, the kind of father I certainly would call myself, who could change a diaper one-handed and open up the porta-crib in 30 seconds and knows how to bottle feed the infant and knows the sleep schedule and all that kind of thing, you would think that the progressive dads maybe would smoke their competition on all sorts of metrics. And on many, they do. But unfortunately, they seem to have a little bit lower marital quality, at least as they rate it. And it seems to be because they're often in co-parenting, really sharing parenting with their spouses. They're arguing a lot over it's two cooks in the kitchen about what the right thing to do is with their kid, and they're getting frustrated. And the other thing that seems to be happening is that the kids of progressive dads were acting out in school and being aggressive in school just as much as the children of disengaged dads, who were the dads that you would think, those would be the aggressive kids. And now, why could this be? Well, when she began to look into it, it seemed to be that progressive dads, we have this chummy, tight bond with our kids. We're not really expecting them to suddenly, do something cruel to another kid or to lash out or throw tantrums. We're not ready for this. And we're not really prepared, maybe emotionally, for the idea and tactically for the idea of how to discipline our children. And since we don't come to disciplining with a certain school or strategy in mind, we tend to be experimentalists. One day of the week, we will you don't get any dessert. The next day it's, I'm going to act all mad and show you how wrong that you were. And the next day they try yet another tactic and yet another tactic. And the science of disciplining kids basically says that no matter what strategy you take, one of the worst things is to be inconsistent. And it's inconsistency of discipline by progressive dads that was sort of was one of the factors leading these kids to maybe act out in school a little more.
Do you think that inconsistency tends to come from the fact that progressive dads might not have their own father as a role model in the same sort of role?
Well, more, I would say many of them. Many of today's progressive dads did have progressive dads themselves. Many of them had traditional dads. And they know what not to do. You know, they know, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. My dad spanked me, so I'm not going to do that. You know, my dad was really mean, or they locked me downstairs. I'm not going to do that. But they don't know what to do. And sort of the way to handle things. When we, progressive dads, we do timeouts. You know, but they don't necessarily work all the time, and so you're trying new strategies, and that's what seems to be. And when I say they're acting out in school, I'm not trying to say that, you know, the terrible, having all sorts of terrible problems by any means. We're just talking about manifesting some sort of a relational aggression, you know, in school and acting out in class a little bit.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is journalist Poe Bronson, whose new book is called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Let's go on the phones to David in Coppell. Hello, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two things, Poe. First of all, thank you for your book, What to Do with My Life, because it helped me a lot when I was transitioning from acting into what's next.
Thanks, David. Appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. And also, germane to the show, you know, there's a lot of controversy about spanking our kids, and you just touched on discipline a little bit. But, you know, as a child, I was born in the 70s and 80s, or raised, rather, and I was spanked probably about 6 times. I know exactly what I did wrong when I was spanked. It was made very clear and that kind of thing. So just wondering what you have found in your research about spanking kids and what, you know, what kind of results you found.
Great question. I want to ask you just one thing, which is when you were spanked by your parent, and you don't have to say mom or dad or anything like that, did the parent who was spanking, had they, were they, you know, doing this because this is what you had done and this is what happens to kids who've done what you've done and this is, it's normal and we're doing this, and they hadn't really, not really lost their temper? Or did they spank you in a moment when, you know, they were really mad and they were offended by what you had done, and they said, you know, this is one of those rare circumstances where you, kid, deserve a spanking, and they were really very upset?
Sort of a combination of both. I mean, the times I was spanked, it was always my dad, and it was very, he made it very, he was very calm.
Yeah.
But he made it very, very clear as to what I had done wrong.
Yeah.
And it was almost always a form of lying.
Right. Well, lying is a different topic, but so let's talk about, you asked a very good question, because there is some fascinating stuff on this. For the longest time, scholars looking at your average samples were seeing that kids who spanked more are more aggressive. So, you know, we didn't know. Nobody knew. Was it that spanking leads to more aggression, or was it that the kids who are acting out more and causing more troubles need to be spanked more? We didn't know which way it worked. But over time, most of the studies of this were really on Caucasian families and sort of ordinary samples. And they hadn't done this cross-culturally, and they hadn't really looked into religious cultures where spanking is considered very normal and even encouraged to a very young age. And I hadn't looked at it in African-American families, which don't necessarily spank more, maybe a tiny bit more on average, but again, where spanking is considered sort of more a way of life rather than this thing that's reserved for special circumstances. And the newest science is saying it wasn't that the parents spanked their kid that led to aggression, it was how the parent had lost their cool in the moment of spanking, and that a parent who maybe spanks very infrequently, but in those moments when they do so, or sort of so offended with what their kid has done, and maybe even acting up the anger to help signal to the child, this was wrong that you did, that is sort of ostracizing the child and making them feel not part of society and really confusing them. A parent who is very calm and says, look, this is what you did, you get a spanking. I know it sounds bad, it's hard for audiences to hear, but that's what they see, is that in those situations, the children aren't being affected by it. Dr. Marjorie Gonneau has done this interesting work. If children who've never been spanked aren't turning out necessarily better on any dimension than children who were spanked a little bit occasionally when they were young, sort of 2 to 6 years old, or even a little bit sort of in the 7 to 9 or 7 to 10 years old. It's when spanking went up into the teen years, in the junior high years, that's obviously when they were sort of seeing the problems. But kids who were only spanked a little bit when young and the parents were not losing their cool are turning out just as well or better than the kids who've never been spanked.
David, our caller, mentioned that when he did get spanked, it was usually about lying. And this is such a vexing issue for parents who are sort of outraged and not just worried, but outraged that their kids don't tell them the truth. And you found some interesting realities about this.
Well, there's two phases of a child's life where lying is going to accelerate and then hopefully sort of decelerate again. And the first is when they're about 3 or 4. 80% of all kids will be lying by their 4th birthday. They'll be experimenting with it. It's something they suddenly can do, and they couldn't do before. They didn't have the language skills. They didn't have the theory of mind, the sort of mental capability to hold the truth and an alternative reality in their head and answer questions about it. And so it's almost a game for them at first. And it does matter how we deal with it. Parents often think your kid's just going to grow out of it. Well, it turns out that they grow into it. They're lying more during that period of time. But ideally, it'll be socialized out of them around by their parents and around the age of 6. If a child is, of all the kids who are sort of still lying at 6 years old, half of them will just have it socialized out of them. Half will hang on to it as a strategy for dealing with difficult circumstances, an idea of I can impress my friends with lying, I can get out of trouble with lying. Whenever it's a difficult situation, I want to make someone happy, I can just lie rather than tell them the truth, which usually seems to upset people. So when it becomes a habit, they tend to hang on to it. The other period of their life that they're going to be lying, and very clear work by Drs. Linda Caldwell and Nancy Darling on this looks at teen lying. And they were able to get teens to tell them the truth that they wouldn't tell their parents. It's kind of too complicated to explain the methodology right now. But it was a very cool way they did this study. And they found that out of 36 potential topics that a teen might lie to their parents about, the average teen was lying to their parents about 12 of them. But even the best kids, the kids who lied the least, were withholding the facts about 5 of those 36 domains. Not because they were necessarily trying to deceive their parents. Sure, they maybe were trying to avoid trouble, but it's important in different phases of their life for some things to be none of a parent's business. The need for autonomy is peaking around age 14, and kids need to feel like if they're always coming to their parents for help with everything, it's psychologically emasculating, it's evidence in some way they can't handle these things on their own, and they're going to hold a few things back. So if parents are offended, 78% of American parents, according to polls, believe their teens can tell them anything. And if they're offended when their teen doesn't, if they're offended when they find out their teen has lied, they're just sort of not living in reality. You know, when I say the average kid is lying to the parents about 12 things, if your kid's lying to you only about 5, you're doing great.
It's good to know. And in fact, it's not a bad sign if you tell them something and they argue back and try to negotiate a different settlement. That's maybe a sign that they're more likely to be telling you the truth.
Right. Arguing is a good thing. We get very hard mentally to rotate this in our heads, but why could arguing be a good thing? Well, to a teenager, they have sort of two choices. They can be like, in their mind, it's tell the parents the truth. They're not going to be happy. We'll argue, but maybe I will get them to sort of change the policy. Allow me to do this. And they're fighting for their autonomy in that moment. Their other choice is it's not about not arguing. It's about lying. Especially here in America, kids see a choice between arguing with their parents and just lying about it, going to do it anyway and not telling their parents the truth. So children, if they're arguing with you, it's because they usually are discussing something. They're working it out. They're trying to assert their autonomy. They're trying to let you change your rules for them. And while that can feel offensive to parents, it can leave them psychologically wrecked after these bouts. Actually, the teens report these things to be very constructive to the relationship with a parent. They think of it as a good thing. And you know, we've heard, no must mean no when kids are toddlers. But when it turns out to be a teen, you shouldn't be a pushover parent by any means. But if your kids have made reasonable arguments, and maybe you've made an error or made a mistake, and you know it's okay to negotiate with them, because what they learn with you in that relationship and how to compromise and how to present good ideas, if they're just lying to you again, I'm not saying do this often, but occasionally to sort of work things out and see the kids from the see the situation from the kid's point of view, that becomes a template that that child takes to their relationships with their peers. Parents are terribly afraid of driving their kids into outright rebellion, when in fact that seems to be a statistical myth. It doesn't happen very often, and parents who tend to have lots of rules and demand obedience turn their kids into the kind of child who is obedient not just to their parents but also to their friends, and they tend to also get very depressed over time because they're not learning to assert themselves.
Poe Bronson is my guest. His book is called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Let's go next on the phones to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. I'm kind of a little troubled when you start making sweeping generalizations like that. I mean, life sometimes gives us time out. Sometimes life knocks us square in the jaw. Sometimes we just, you know, like I say, we get bored, we get fined. And, you know, my parents always liked to, or gave me a chance to state my case. Mm-hmm. That wasn't any good for growing up. You don't often get to state your case. And I have three kids. They're similar. They go through phases in and out of these things. Social sciences are not sciences. You can't control for the ability to make meaning, interpreting, and these things. It's the weakest of the sciences, and I find it totally fascinating. And I'm not diminishing it, but it's a
okay. Well,
you know,
good point.
Let's
talk about this. Really, you're making a good point, which is the things that I were saying tend to be what's developmentally normative. So they're looking at broad averages and they're looking at these trajectories, right? And a lot of social science was launched, you know, a decade ago. And 5 years ago, it was kicking out findings about what's normal, right? In the last 5 years, they've been able to kick out lots of findings that look at things cross-culturally and through different ethnicities. And most recent social science is looking at individual trajectories. The science has actually gotten much better to see what kids were like when they were young and what they're like now, and recognizes the fact that not all kids are the same.
Poe Bronson is my guest. His new book is called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Poe Bronson. His new book is called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to switch gears here a little bit, excuse me, Poe, and talk about school, because like the good people of Lake Wobegon, we all want our children to be above average.
Mm-hmm.
You've found a big issue in schools with giftedness testing. Turns out we may be jumping the gun.
Yeah. Parents are around the country are competing madly to get their kids into these gifted programs and independent private schools as early as possible. The kids who are in those programs, they get taught more. They get these sort of rarefied environments. It can be good for them, at least cognitively, though there's a lot of debate about all the other dimensions of it. But certainly it seems to be something that parents really want. And gifted programs have grown dramatically. There's now 3 million kids. 7% of the American school system is in gifted tracking, as well another 2 million kids who are in the independent private schools who, by and large, use early intelligence testing to find these kids and admit them. And we polled the top 20 largest school districts in the country. Dallas is one of them. As for at what stage do they put kids into this program and how many of their spots are they allocating very early and how much are they saving for later? And saving for later is going to be really important because at the entrance to kindergarten or during kindergarten and the end of kindergarten or the entrance to first grade, when a lot of this testing is actually going on, kids' brains are not very developed. And the kids who are smart at that age, it's sort of like some kids have lost a tooth and other kids haven't lost a tooth yet. And some kids have sprouted in height and other kids haven't sprouted in height. The brain is going through dramatic, rapid progression towards real intelligence over the course of the next decade in their lives, and especially so in those sort of first grade, second grade, third grade through fifth grade years, as their brain is syncing up the front of the brain with the back of the brain through these large white matter tracts, converting gray matter in the brain into white matter as they select one nerve over the other. And the result is, unfortunately, this is sort of tough math, but, you know, one-third of the highest-achieving third graders would have tested or did test below average prior to kindergarten or in kindergarten. It just took a while for the brains to develop. You know, and as a result, the intelligence tests and achievement tests used for kindergarten screening, and in whether it's entrance to kindergarten or kindergarten, seem to be picking the wrong kids or missing the best kids 73% of the time.
But
I'm not just hearing this like from people who object to these tests. I'm not saying the tests are bad. They test correctly for where the child is in the moment. Just where the child is in the moment isn't necessarily where they're going to be even just 2 years down the road. And this becomes a problem in school districts when kids are given this placement in the school and they're never retested and they're never checked to see if they really still belong there. And the spots, and some places, I'm talking to you today from New York City, which gives up all of its slots, practically every slot, to kids at the entrance to kindergarten, and has no slots left for the kids whose brains are developing on a little bit later track.
And the other interesting non-correlation is the fact that some of the kids who are identified in kindergarten as being just prodigiously gifted might turn out to be sort of average students later on.
Absolutely. That they sprouted. Their brain sprouted early. They took the test. They did well. And that gave them, got them to the thing. But the brain isn't actually any better down the road. And and therefore, they maybe don't necessarily belong in the gifted program, or they're going to fall behind. Now, some places like Dallas, they're continuously kind of checking in with the kids. Dallas, for instance, doesn't give away too many slots too young. So it's not nearly as bad as some of the other places that I talked to. But at the same time, Dallas doesn't have as quite as exciting a prize. They don't have the special gifted academies where as many kids get to go. It's more like you get to go off a couple days a week into a special classroom and do math with a different teacher or something in the younger ages. So it's a difficult science. It's not really clear what the science is saying we should do, because school does start at these ages. But the science says if we could just wait a few years, wait till third grade for the kids' brains to have developed, we would be testing kids and get it right at over twice the predictive power as we do by doing it so early back in kindergarten.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Alex in Dallas. Hello, Alex.
Yes, hi. I'm 28 years old. My daughter is 4, and I kind of saw what popular culture and the pop culture icons and the media and all the different art forms could do to me and the rest of my friends in terms of prioritizing look and vanity when I was younger. My daughter's 4. She already has caught wind of who Hannah Montana and the Jonas Brothers and all those other folks are. And the one underlying theme is they all look tremendous, and their appearance and the way that they look, and it's all based very much on popularity and approval. Should I be afraid of overexposure to those pop culture icons, or do I stigmatize it if I disallow her to be exposed to such interesting characters?
Great, it's a great question, you know, I'm going to have to say there's science looking at this, but I don't feel like it has nailed it in a way that I could sort of give you one side or another on that. You know, I apologize for that I can't just give you the answer, but Thomas had called earlier and he'd said, you know, that maybe social science is a weak science and to be careful making generalizations. you know, this book takes 10 specific lines of inquiry and looks very, very deeply into the science that's available. And I believe it's important for parents to sort of get informed, not just go off their instincts, but not trust me, not trust some scientists because they've got an fMRI scanner. You know, get informed and then do what you think is best for your child, because every child is different. And I think that that's important. And in this case, there is a lot of concern, for sure, that these styles and they're mimicked on TV, and they call it sexy TV, and they consider this imagery, they call it a sexual super peer, that it's sort of creating a sexualized great best friend, Hannah Montana, as your sort of imaginary friend, and you want to be like her and be older very quickly, and it is having an impact on kids. But at the same time, it depends on the kid. And some kids are still doing great in school and able to decipher, it's just for fun, Dad. And, you know, it kind of depends on your kid's perspective for these things.
I want to talk about race here for a minute, because I think a lot of parents want to raise very tolerant kids who look at everybody as a human being as opposed to whatever racial background they may bring. And I think a lot of people who think this way, we assume that if a kid says something that has sort of racist overtones, that they've been taught that somewhere. They've learned it at home, and that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. For the longest time, we just assumed kids will only see race if we point it out to them. That racism came entirely because society taught it to them. And if we never mention race, kids will never have any sort of same race categorization, same race preferences whatsoever. And the developmental science has been quite clear on this. You know, 75% of American white parents never or almost never talk about race. Now, they might say things like everybody's equal or God made us all the same, but they never really point out skin color. And they're thinking, well, my kid is racially colorblind, and if I point it out to them and then say it means nothing, we don't want you to care about skin color, and it's sort of like, it seems hypocritical. Like, well, why did I point it out if it means nothing? So we're kind of, this is a very common deduction that parents are making. But the science says that by the time kids are 7 months old, if they hold up faces on cards, and the kids will stare at other race faces longer because they haven't seen them as often, and they're trying to get used to that and trying to interpret it, and what does it mean? And if you hand three-year-olds a deck of cards with kids' faces on them and you ask them, which of these kids do you think would like, you'd like to be your, they'd like to be your friend, or you'd like to be their friend? And especially for white kids, most of them will pick kids of their same race. And these are the kids whose very parents in polls will say, oh, my kid doesn't see skin color, doesn't even notice it. And we never talk about it. And at the same kids at age four, if you hand them the same deck of cards again, and now you say, sort the deck into two piles, any way you want, just go ahead, sort it into two piles. 16% of kids will sort it by gender. 16% will find some other thing in the picture to sort it by. But 68% of kids will use, four-year-olds will use race to sort it into two piles. And while we imagine our kids are colorblind, they're actually seeing skin color. It's as obvious as princesses and ninjas and pink shirts and blue shirts to them. And nobody's talking about what it means. And so they're wondering what it means. And they have this developmental trait called essentialism, the idea that sort of things that look similar to you share traits as you, and you like them better. And they go, they're relentlessly trying to categorize the world. And unless we, the science says that unless we talk to them about this, talk to them about skin color and what it means and doesn't mean, and it's wrong to choose kids on the friends on the basis of their race, and it's very important to treat everybody the same no matter what their skin color. If you ignore it, not only is a child making these deductions on their own without your help, but you're actually showing them that it's taboo, that they can't talk about it, that parents don't like it. If you notice that, you know, my, in my daughter's case, she went to a preschool in San Francisco. Her best girlfriend was black, and her two best boyfriends were black, and, you know, we were afraid to talk to her, you know. But she knew what the color of their skin was. She loved them. She didn't care. But she was wondering, when we finally talked to her about it, why we'd never brought it up before.
Hmm.
And what have we been trying to say? By never talking about it.
So is that the big thing that you changed in terms of all of this research in your own parenting?
Yeah, that's it's probably pretty important. I mean, as I'm very supportive of school integration and as a child of integrated schools, when I grew up in Seattle, it was interesting to hear this very different science on it. It was eye-opening. And learning to talk openly about race with my kids and talk about what's right and wrong very strongly from early age probably to me stands out as one of the sort of biggest surprises of the research for me and one of the biggest changes that I had to make, because I did think that talking about race was absolutely taboo. And I was afraid that I was going to teach old racial constructs if I even talked about it with my kids. But now my son is 8, and he's really into his African-American history and his African-American sports biographies, and he's studying Africa. And, you know, he's a white child. He's very comfortable with these things, as is my daughter. And it's nice that they're not feeling like it's taboo.
So, Poe, we try to find our kids the best schools. We try to teach them our values. We try to make sure that they have everything they need. We read books. We might be just as well served making sure that every night of their lives they get enough sleep as any of those other things.
Well, I mean, that's one or the other.
A bit of a generalization,
but yes,
it's a big deal.
It turns out to be really important. It's fascinating. Sleep is a number one concern for parents of infants, you know, just trying to get them to sleep through the night and get through their naps. And it seems to drop off the radar when they sort of hit school, in elementary school. And we're not really aware how much we're sort of stealing sleep from our kids' lives. But actually, you know, we all remember being tired when we were in high school. But today's high schoolers are getting an hour less than we got. They're on average sleeping 6.65 hours a night. When I was the same age, we weren't getting enough, but it was like, you know, 7.5 hours a night. And this comes all the way down to elementary school kids. Even kindergarten kids are getting a half hour less sleep than they used to. And the cost is surprising, that it has cognitive elements. It's tied to the obesity epidemic. It's affecting self-regulation in moods, and in some studies showing that it could be responsible for 25% of the ADHD cases.
So at least 8 hours, 9 hours in elementary
school?
Well,
no, this is the thing that's important. You know, if you hear sleep scientists talk, they'll say, well, your kid should sleep without an alarm clock because otherwise you're not getting enough sleep, and they want you to sleep forever. And nobody's going to do that. I mean, and it turns out that if you steal the first hour of what a kid might sleep completely, they tend to do okay. But when you steal the second hour, which is what we've done unwittingly over the last 30 years, there's an enormous fall off there in these different abilities. And so on average in high school, A students average 15 more minutes sleep than B students, who average 15 minutes more sleep than C students.
So
now that's on
good.
Average. It doesn't apply to any one kid, but
good to keep in mind.
Every 15 minutes counts.
So sorry that we're out of time. Poe Bronson's new book is called Nurture Shock. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.